culture, in fact, world Western culture, what Homer was to Greek culture. He's not only the person, but he's the language basis upon which full self-realization is pivoted. The plays of Shakespeare do not just occur. They're not just a brilliant array of world-class genius, universal genius, but they occur in patterns. Usually they occur in patterns of four. Now there are four plays that that form the first whole pattern. There's Richard II, there's Love's Labor, Lost, there's Romeo and Juliet, and A Midsummer Night's Dream. And those four plays, written in the early 1590s, written about 400 years ago, are the first expression of the young Shakespeare coming into his wholeness. And of those four, the last one to be written in that sequence was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it's the most lyrical because it's the most refined he's capable at that extent. A Midsummer Night's Dream is like Shakespeare's signature saying, I can do it. It's like Rudyard Kipling writing Kim when he was 36, and it was his way of saying, Englishmen can understand the process of enlightenment. Here's a story of enlightenment. It's like that. It's like a great writer who was able to display mastery of the form of language which can deliver the ineffable. And A Midsummer Night's Dream is that way. In the structure of Midsummer Night's Dream, there are five acts. The play moves in five sequences. So that one looks then, symbolically and strategically, to the center of the play, the third act, the third of the five acts. This is where the complementarity will come into play. This is where the apparent polarity would be focused. This is where the mind would have its acutest expression. And in fact, if we open A Midsummer Night's Dream to the beginning of the third act, we find right away that Shakespeare puts us into a strategic location. He puts us into the beginnings of the play within the play. That within this play, there is another play. And in fact, this other play is not just the play within the play, but the whole process, the entire ecology. That is to say, not only the play, but the writing of the play, the rehearsing of the play, the characters who go to make up the play, they are all with the play, within the play, a self-structure that's embedded in the middle of it. So that if the play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, is like a living thing, the play within the play is the heart of it. Just like the play with its other three forms a quaternary of a whole view of the human self. A Midsummer Night's Dream with Love's Labor's Lost, and Romeo and Juliet with Richard II. And if we lived in a comprehensive society that understood things, the plays would be played in quartets like that. And there are many quartets of plays in Shakespeare. They'd be presented in cycles. Just like in Athens, one would never have presented Aeschylus or Sophocles or Euripides with just one play. You present the trilogy. They go together. And not only the trilogy, there was always a fourth play, a satyr play, the comic relief to go with the tragic trilogy. There's always that kind of a structure. We'll be civilized someday. Here's how the play within the play, right at the beginning of chapter 3, begins. I assume that you're all familiar with the story somewhat. If not, just follow along and do the best you can. There's a pair of couples of Greek young people, two men and two women, who are trying to figure out who loves who and why, and thus have gotten confused, and have ended up out in the woods outside of Athens, lost. And they're actually not very deep in the woods, because as they get lost, in the same vicinity comes a little troupe of actors. They're craftsmen, a tailor, and a shoemaker, and a cobbler, a butcher, and they're village people. And they're going to put on a little skit, a little play, for a royal wedding that's to take place the next day. And this is the play within the play. And the play that they're going to rehearse is taken from Ovid, Pyramus and Thisbe. Well, as they enter, here comes Bottom, Peter Quince, who's the author of the play, quote, author, Snout, Starveling, Snug, and Flute. And you can see by their names, they're not very distinguished persons in the community. But Shakespeare means to say that they're extremely apt to express the play within the play. That is to say, they don't have any kind of worldly complications, so they express just instantaneously the structure which we would wish to observe. And the beginning is Bottom, who says, "Are we all met?" For that is the question to ask about the deep interior self. To ask of all the structures that count, that should be together, are we all here? Are we all met? Peter Quince says, "Pat, pat, and here's a marvelous convenient place for our rehearsal. This green plot shall be our stage. This hawthorn brake, our tiring house, and we will do in it action as we will do it before the Duke." And Bottom says, "Peter Quince, what sayest thou, bully Bottom? There are things in this comedy of Pyramus and Thisbe that will never please. First, Pyramus must draw a sword to kill himself, which the ladies cannot abide. How answer you that?" And Snout, keeping to his namesake, butts in, says, "Byre Lake and a perilous fair." Starveling comes in and chimes, because he loves to get a word in edgewise, as long as everyone's talking. "I believe we must leave the killing out when all is done." And Bottom, "Not a whit. I have a device to make all well. Write me a prologue, and let the prologue seem to say we will do no harm with our swords, and that Pyramus is not killed indeed. And for the more better assurance, tell them that I, Pyramus, am not Pyramus, but Bottom, the weaver. This will put them out of fear." Notice the complications that come in over appearance and reality. And Shakespeare is juggling appearances now. We have a play within a play, and they're just trying to decide in the play within the play just how this play within the play is going to go. And Bottom says, "Well, we have to leave some tabs sticking out so they can pull on them and see, well, this is all just a play within a play." What's curious is that the denouement of this whole thing will be that Shakespeare will present A Midsummer Night's Dream as if it were a play within a play itself. The whole play is A Midsummer Night's Dream. He's doing in large what Peter Quince and all of his people are doing in minute. So that the audience that views A Midsummer Night's Dream are meant to wake up. We'll wait for them. Tiring you? You just fed up with it? Can't stand it? Now, skip over some of the complications because they go on with this. They start talking about, well, now you've got a lion written in here, and is its roar going to scare the ladies and all that? And they go through all of this. Everything is a problem. Everything is a problem. And they discuss the wall, who's going to be the wall. While this is happening, in comes a fairy sprite named Puck. And Puck comes in. He sees these people who are trying to get the self together. And Puck is the trickster who is a part of that self and whose part is to play devil's advocate and get them going. So Shakespeare very, very competently just writes, enter Puck. And Puck comes in. What hempen homespuns have we swaggering here so near the cradle of the fairy queen? What? A play toward? I'll be an auditor, an actor too, perhaps, if I see cause. And he starts to scramble the whole scene coming into play. And I'm going to skip over. He ends up with this kind of a confusion that he's going to change Bottom so that Bottom has an ass's head through magic. Bottom with the ass's head next to Puck, who's invisible to all of them. The trickster is always an invisible. Bottom comes in, and Peter Quince expresses for all of them, oh monstrous, oh strange, we are haunted. Pray, masters, fly, masters, help. And they all scatter through the woods. Poor Bottom is left. And Puck, I'll follow you, I'll lead you about, around, through bog, through bush, through brake, through briar. Sometimes a horse I'll be, sometimes a hound. A hog, a headless bear, sometimes a fire. And neigh, and bark, and grunt, and roar, and burn. Like horse, hound, hog, bear, fire at every turn. Bottom says to himself, why do they run away? This is a knavery of them to make me afeard. He falls into a scene where Titania, the queen of the fairies, wakes up, and of course, as she wakes up, the first thing she sees she's going to fall in love with, and it's Bottom the weaver with an ass's head. So the queen of the fairy realm is not only falling in love with a mortal, but sort of the lowest of mortals, but even that lowest of mortals with an ass's head yet. But love him she does, because the magic of the love potion is undeniable. She has four little fairies who are the quaternary around her. She's the quintessence. There's Moth, there's Peas Blossom, there's Cobweb, and there's Mustard Seed. Wonderful little fairies, Elizabethan fairies. While all this is happening, the king of the fairies comes in, and he sees that the trickster Puck has scrambled everything. He's scrambled the fairy realm. He's scrambled the realm of the play within the play. He's scrambled the two pairs of lovers from Athens. He's got the whole woods seething with confusion. Here comes my messenger. How now, mad spirit? What night rule now this haunted grove? My mistress with a monster is in love, near to her close and consecrated bower. While she was in her dull and sleeping hour, crew of patches, rude mechanicals that work for bread upon Athenian stalls, were met together to rehearse a play intended for great Theseus's nuptial day, the shallowest, thick skin of the barren sort, who Pyramus presented in their sport, forsook his scene and entered into a break, when I did him at this advantage take, an ass's knoll I fixed on his head, and on his Thisbe must be answered, and forth my mimic comes, when they him spy, as wild geese that the creeping fowler eye, or russet-pated chokes, many and sort, rising and cawing at the gun's report, sever themselves and madly sweep the sky, so at his sight away his fellows fly. And at our stamp here o'er and o'er one falls, he murder cries, and help from Athens calls. Their sense thus weak, lost with their fears thus strong, made senseless things begin to do them wrong. For briars and thorns at their apparel snatch, some sleeves, some hats, from yielders all things catch. I led them on in this distracted fear, and left sweet Pyramus translated there. When in that moment, so it came to pass, Titania waked and straightway loved an ass. So that when all the elements for the interior self are brought together, they don't just happen to fall together. One of the elements that has to be worked in is Puck, the trickster. It is an element of the self, has to be worked in, and its work is to confuse the whole lot. Love's confusion. Oh boy, an order to mix up. That's its nature. If it weren't that way, it wouldn't be that element. So when you're putting the whole self together, the deep self, that element is always there. Always there. The idea that the yogi is some calm, abstracted thing is a Victorian projection. That's not true at all. It's like Lord of the Rings, Gandalf the Wizard is more like a wise person. You better watch out. Yeah, it's like that. All of this has to be put back together, and only Oberon is able to sort this out, and the way he puts it back together is he takes Puck as the restructuring element. He has introduced the chaos. Now he's the very vehicle that brings it back into an order. Not only does it bring it back into an order so that the fairy realm is together, but the human realm is together on the level of the lovers, and the royal realm is together on the marriage of Theseus and his queen. And fourth, the play within the play is together. So that with all of this, the universe is reordered again. I'll give you the last bit of Puck. He says, then will two at once woo one. That must needs be sport alone. And those things do best please me that befall preposterously. And at the end of the play, at the end of the fifth act, here is Oberon's commanding of Puck to bring in a broom and to clean up the mess, finally with a seal. And this is how Puck's, the last speech of Puck in the play runs like this. This is line 350, act 5. Now the hungry lion roars and the wolf behowls the moon, whilst the heavy plowman snores, all with weary task foredone. Now the wasted brands do glow, whilst the screech owl screeching loud puts the wretch that lies in woe in remembrance of a shroud. Now it is the time of night that the graves all gaping wide, everyone lets forth his sprite in the churchway paths to glide. And we fairies that do run by the triple Hecate's team from the presence of the sun, following darkness like a dream, now our frolic, not a mouse shall disturb this hallowed house. I am sent with broom before to sweep the dust behind the door. He doesn't clean the house out. He doesn't sweep the dust out. He sweeps it behind the door. The next night, they'll be at it again. But now, he's been told, this is a special day when things have to go right, at least for today. This is Oberon's blessing of the house. At the very end of the play, now until the break of day, through this house each fairy stray, to the best bride bed will we, which by us shall blessed be, and the issue there create shall ever be fortunate. So shall all the couples three ever true and loving be, and the blots of nature's hand shall not in their issue stand. Never mole, hair lip, nor scar, no mark prodigious, such as are despised in nativity, shall upon their children be. With this field dew, consecrate, each fairy takes his gate, and gate as in G-A-I-T, his rhythm, so that the rhythm of all the fairies together is a harmonia. And each several chambers bless, through this palace with sweet peace, and the owner of it, blessed, ever shall in safety rest. Trip away, make no stay, meet me all by break of day. And then Shakespeare does a magical thing, which raises him to an ultimate level. He's a very great magician. He writes, exit all but Puck. And so the play, A Midsummer Night's Dream, is over, and Puck remains on the stage. The play is over. Everything has happened. A Puck is on the stage. And he speaks not in the play, but he speaks to the audience outside the play, outside of the shape of the play, a last smidgen of the trickster, who's the only element that can leave that unity, talks to the audience straight. He says, if we shadows have offended, think but this, and all is mended, that you have but slumbered here while these visions did appear, and this weak and idle theme, no more yielding but a dream. Gentles, do not reprehend. If you pardon, we will mend, and as I am an honest Puck, if we have unearned luck, now to scape the serpent's tongue, we will make amends ere long, else Puck a liar call. So, good night to you all. Give me your hands if we be friends, and Robin shall restore amends. And then he flits off the stage, which is no longer a stage, but is a space within the room where the audience actually lives. And this is Shakespeare's magical way of showing that when you raise magic to a techne, to an art, what occurs is the real personal realm where we can live completely, fully, as ourselves. Get yourself a copy of the play and try and read it. Thank you.